Everyone, welcome to the very first 2017 meeting of the Joint Committee on Marijuana Regulation. I see a lot of familiar faces out there. It's been quite an adventure so far, and we hope to continue moving forward this session to make a program that is really successful for our legalized cannabis industry. I thought I'd start out by having the committee members very briefly introduce themselves. I want to call out especially Representative Fahey down there, who is our only new committee member. I can't believe that everybody else just stuck with it, including me. So we'll start with Representative Helm.
I was going to say we got drafted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ken Helm, I represent District 34, which is parts of Beaverton, Cedar Hills, West Haven, and West Slope in the Portland metropolitan area.
You want me to go next?
Please.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
If you'd be so kind.
Oh, thank you. Andy Olson, State Representative from Albany.
Julie Fahey, State Representative from West Eugene Junction City, and happy to be joining the group.
Hi there. Carl Wilson, State Rep, House District 3, Grants Pass, Cave Junction, Selma, Kirby, Williams, all points in between.
Norman voice.
What happened? Ann Leininger, State Rep for Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, and one of the co-chairs of the committee. And I just want to say that it's so great to be back in this room with this group of people, with the new addition of Rep Fahey, and all the wonderful people in the room. You know, working with this group has been delightful, and we've done some good work, and not everything has pleased everyone, but we've got a track record of trying to evolve our work and work together in a way that makes sense, and I look forward to doing that one more year.
We'll take a momentary pause because we are doing introductions. I'm going to go after.
Oh, you're going to go last.
What is this, priority or what?
So, would you please introduce yourself, Mr. Co-Vice Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ted Ferrioli, Senate District 30, all are part of 11 counties, beginning in Marion County and Clackamas County and ending at the Idaho-Nevada border.
State Senator Floyd Przanski, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. And some of us enlisted, others got drafted.
Gee, that was a long time ago on that one. Lee Byer, State Senator from District 6, which is Central Lane and Lane counties.
Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is southwestern Oregon, and I would point out that Senator Przanski and I have been involved with the medical program since 99. So we've been at this a while.
Yes, we have.
Participants?
No.
Yes.
Thank you. And I'm Jenny Burdick. I represent the people of Senate District 18, which is parts of West Portland and the city of Tigard. So we will get going with our agenda now. We are going to end promptly at 7 o'clock. The agenda says 2 hours, but we're going to be ending at 7. And then Chair Leininger and I are going to have a crusade to have this committee start at 5 instead of 5:30 so that people can get home and get on with their lives. So we will start with adoption of committee rules, which is a pretty routine thing to do. So Adam, do you want to just go over briefly what we will be doing? Oh, I'm opening an organizational meeting. That's what I'm doing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee rules are otherwise posted to OLIS. They are very similar to the rules from 2015 and 2016. Just a few things to note. The committee cannot act on an amendment unless it has otherwise been posted to OLIS publicly for at least an hour. The committee can discuss it, but the committee cannot adopt it into a motion or adopt it into a measure. Also, because this is a joint committee, we have to take the more onerous of the two rules, whether the House or the Senate chamber rule, when it comes to public meeting notice. Namely, this means for any public testimony and any public hearings we post for, there has to be at least 72 hours of notice, not including weekend hours. Other than that, Madam Chair, very similar to the committee rules from 2015 and 2016.
Great. Okay, Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, ma'am. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Senator Ferrioli has moved to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay. We have no committee measures before us. Normally, we use this time to introduce committee measures. So we will move on to our informational meeting. So I will open the informational meeting on the current state of marijuana regulation. And our panel will be, do they all come, just these two? Okay. We'll start with the OLCC panel, Steve Marks, Will Higland, and Renee Niedermeyer.
Identification information.
So that's personal identification.
Did it say personal?
Got it.
If you're going to say personal, you need.
Welcome.
Co-chairs, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. I'll let Renee and Will introduce themselves as they go through their parts of the presentation. It's been a long ride to get where we are, and I think we're going to show you here some good news. We intend to show you sort of what our system's produced in terms of licensing, and then in terms of sort of the sales that are taking place now within the system. And then I'll talk briefly about some of the go-forward issues and some of the compliance issues that we're now looking at now addressing. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to them.
Good evening, Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Will Higland. I'm the Senior Director of Licensing and Compliance for the OLCC. Thanks for the opportunity to join you tonight. So I get the fun part to show you where we've gone and where we are now with the industry as far as licensing. And so I think I'll just jump right in. So you can see from the stats, we've talked a lot about the volume of licenses we've received over the last couple of years. And if you look at the third bullet, the original estimate for 15-17 budget is what we would receive 1,000 licenses and probably have 800 in total that would be approved. That was real data from Washington and Colorado based on their experience, our population, and what we thought would happen. That did not happen, as you can see from the data I'll show you. So to date, we have 20 active laboratory licenses. I'm going to give you the updated numbers. They're not going to match this specifically because I got them updated before the meeting. We have 66 processors, 413 producers, 330 retailers, 49 wholesalers, for a total of 911 licensees statewide. So that I think that's the good news, and there's more good news here, but the challenging news is if you look to the far right, we have over 2,000 applications in the system, so we're not even halfway through all the people that have applied for a license. The other challenging thing has been is I've looked back just recently, and when we flipped over to January 1st, has looked at January 1st, we've issued, let me get this right, 167 licenses since January 1st. We have received 169 applications. So we haven't been gaining ground on the overall number, which will be very challenging. And the reason I say that is because Director Marks will talk a little bit about compliance. And as you know, we've leveraged the entire organization to get where we are with our liquor investigators and our marijuana personnel. We had 12 marijuana personnel in the budget to do licensing and compliance. We're going to begin to move, we have begun to move those people over to compliance. We're dealing with some real issues right now. The end result of that is that licensing will slow down. We'll stay on it. We'll do the best we can, but we have limited resources. You know, it was easy when we didn't have any product and we were just focused on licensing, but we have a market now that we need to regulate, make sure that we're doing everything we can to keep it in compliance. So just for the record, I wanted you to understand that. And then the other challenging point, it's hard to believe, but we're going to start our annual renewal process here in about 90 days. So we started issuing our first licenses in May. They're annual licenses, so we're going to have to go through that whole process at the same time. So it's exciting news. You know, I think we, you know, the market's up. It's great news from that respect, from an operations perspective, though we have a lot of challenges moving forward. So unless you have questions for me, I'll turn it over to Renee.
Senator Brzezinski.
Well, just following up on that, knowing that the annuals are going to be coming up and knowing what the backlog is, can you tell us if you're going to give them priority or are you going to give them some type of a waiver as long as they've made their application that they can continue in business without being caught in this catch-22?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I'll just tell you what I think. We haven't really fleshed that out, but I think the priority needs to go to the people that are renewing so they're in compliance. We haven't had a discussion about potentially a waiver or anything like that. That's good thinking. We can take that back and look at it. But the priority will need to be to keep people in the legal market legal, so they don't have any problems there.
Thank you.
Okay, continue.
Madam Chair, on that topic.
Yes.
Is no one in the agency able to see the wreck that will come from doubling up on the, you know, current license backlog and the renewals? So we're just going to let that wreck happen. Would you need authority from the legislature to, I mean, we're going to have a complaint-driven system. You're busy investigating the new applications. You don't have any complaints, probably, in backlog that need to be investigated.
Can we hold this line of discussion?
I just want to get this on the record, Madam Chair. So wouldn't it be a wise thing for you to ask for permission to renew all the renewals for another year and start staggering your renewals, or give us a 2-year license period so we don't have to have everybody back through the door on the same annualized process?
So just to clarify, Chairs, Senator Farioli, so just remember, when we started off, we started with a small number of licensees coming up in renewals, so those build, and then when you get to about September, October, we got a big group there.
And
then
I started out as a small child. Yeah. Look at me. Madam Chair, the question can be answered offline, but the suggestion is that just looking out in the future, you guys are just going to get drowned, you know, by our own bureaucracy, and don't let that happen.
I think our vice chair is inviting you to come up with proposals if necessary. Is that correct, Mr. Vice Chair?
Madam Chair. Yeah. You said it better than I did. Thank you.
I'll just add, council just told me, like alcohol, they'll get to continue to operate under their license until they expire. So we'll be able to catch up. You know, that gives us some time, and that happens in the alcohol process regularly. But there's no doubt there's a lot behind us. There's a wave there.
For the record, my name is Renee Niedermeyer. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the OLCC. Madam co-chairs and committee members, what I'm going to be doing today is just working through some of our cannabis tracking system statistics that I think will give you a little overview of what's happening, what we're seeing so far in the recreational market. So the very first slide, our total marijuana sales. This is for all products, for sales to recreational customers as well as cardholders. And what you can see is there's an obvious jump after January 1st. That's pretty obvious. And you're going to see, we're going to be real interested to see what happens week by week as we go through. Are there going to be trends? Sometimes in alcohol there are trends. We expect that there might be similar trends in marijuana sales. So we're going to be looking at that very closely and plan to do these sort of statistics on a weekly basis so we can track that very closely.
Oops.
The second slide tells total sales by week by customer type. So the red in this chart are the recreational sales, and the blue or green, however it comes out on your slide, are the cardholder sales. And you can see that those follow the same trends as the total sales. So both recreational sales have obviously started pretty strongly on January 1st, but it was interesting that cardholder sales did as well.
How do you explain the cardholder sale increase, since they've had access all along?
Madam Chair, my explanation, you'd really have to dig deep into that, but one possible explanation would be they want to go to their local stores, and so they're buying the product.
We'll ask for it, Chair.
And a lot of their local dispensary that they went to converted to us, so they're going to the same place maybe where they bought their medical product before, but now it's an OLCC location.
This next sale slide is very interesting because this is this will be really telling as we move forward. This is actually sales per week by an active retailer by product type. And what's interesting about it is in the very beginning, we only had 18 retailers, so all the sales were divided up amongst 18 retailers. The last week, and these were measured as last Friday, we had 259 retailers. But those averages are still staying pretty close right now, around the $17,000 a week. And you can also see their averages for not only usable marijuana, but edibles and tinctures and concentrates and extracts. And we'll look at that trend line a little closer. Again, market share, the bulk of what's being sold are usable marijuana. We expect that maybe over time that will transition, but we'll be watching again, watching that very closely. One of the questions that we had, that we've had from people, is testing. What's happening with testing? And you're all aware of that there have been changes in testing rules and some issues there. When we look at the data, this is the status as of February 3rd. If we had gone back 1 week from that, what we would have found is that of the test pass, there'd be about 4,000 tests passed and about 1,200 tests that were waiting to be done. 1 week later, we have 5,800 tests that have been done and 2,200. We've kind of seen this number of the test waiting move somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000. It'll move back and forth depending upon when those products are submitted for testing. Of those tests that have gone out, 343 have failed. And then these next few slides just break out the trend lines for the usable marijuana itself. It pretty much follows the trend line of total sales, concentrate and extract trend lines. You can see that.
I think let me just add there, this is an important one. This shows our testing and some of that work that's streamlining. We're actually getting those products through and testing. They're starting to grow within the market.
And that same pattern shows in the edible and tinctures as well. One of the questions is, how much have you sold? And so on the recreational sale, and this is from the beginning of our sales for recreational sales to last Friday, we're up to $46.8 million total sales. Of that, 40.7 were recreational sales and 6.1 million were sales to cardholders. So the medical sales percentage, and we've noticed every week this has stayed pretty consistent, is about 13% of the total volume that's coming out of our system. And if you do simple math, 17% times the 40.7, that's about 6.9 million in revenue so far. The other question is, how are we doing on packaging and labeling? And in the very beginning, I think that was a kind of a sticking point and a real concern for folks. Our board took some steps to augment the safety of products. They prohibited some names and words that were attractive to children. And they did one thing that speeded up the process, I think, a little bit, and that's having child-resistant packages certified by third parties. But what we've done, and part of it is the outreach, if we're going out and having informational sessions. We had two last week still. We're continuing to have informational sessions at OLCC headquarters and around the state, not just on packaging and labeling, but on licensing and compliance. But we've, on packaging and labeling specifically, we've had seven informational sessions at our headquarters. We've gone out to three industries, given presentations. We've done rule updates in Eugene, Bend, and Ashland. We don't have a backlog right now. This normally we don't have zero in this, you know, here, but Jamie happened to be perfectly caught up on the day that we measure, and we've got the packages and labels out there and approved.
Back to me. So moving forward, we've continued to be a part. You know, the governor's office and OHA really have taken the lead in working through streamlining of testing requirements, but we continue to be involved in working with them to help that move forward. And compliance, as Will was talking about, we're starting to look at now how we do investigations. Really, and we want to come to you with some recommendations and thoughts about the kind of problems we have with our sanctioning system, you know, some of the big challenges we have if we had to take on pounds and pounds of marijuana and what we have to do with it right now. We need some ease in being able to deal with those issues, and I think we've got at least some ideas that will be interesting to you and I think better for the system in terms of preserving product and making sure that product isn't necessarily wasted when we have compliance issues and maybe have to shut down a licensee. Law enforcement coordination. Law enforcement coordination continues to be an issue. You know, as you consider integration, it may be less so, but there's a lot of confusion between, you know, what kinds of grows are out there in the countryside, and you can't identify them. Some are hemp grows, some are OHA. We can always identify our grows for them. But we've become the go-to spot for all of the calls on people who want to know what's happening out there in their communities. So we think some coordination for both law enforcement through us and for citizens and cities through that as well. Maybe there's different levels of information that we need to coordinate. And we've already taken on sort of establishing that, a call line so that people can call, law enforcement can call, and is dedicated to them. Licensing, we've talked about the new applications coming in and, you know, our resource constraints. I'm not going to belabor that, but I just want to show you what we've done. On our budget and our initial projections for getting this work done, we were somewhere between 800 and 1,200 licenses that we expected to license, and we're already in that range today. And the biennium has five more months, so we've got a lot more coming. You know, as our revenues grow and we do more licensing, we do get more revenue inside that. So with FTE authority, we can help match that need, but we don't have FTE authority and even the current biennium above that line. We've had good relationship every time we went and had the opportunity to ask when we needed resources. We've gotten them. They've been meted out as we've needed them, and we're in need now. We're starting to move into enforcement. So you see the wave behind it, and it'll be an issue for the remainder of this biennium. It'll be an issue starting next biennium. And we're starting to have some compliance problems that are pretty widespread. We had some problems with recording of data in the metric system, particularly 20% of our licensees were out of compliance with metric reporting. It's about heavy in the producers. About 50% of the producers had issues. Some of those issues still showed standing plants, you know, and outdoor gardens, and it's been a lot of snow and rain and wind, so we don't think there's flowering plants out there. Some of them were harvests, and we had the wet weight recorded, and we have a requirement that you got to move it into another package in metric in 45 days. So you got time to harvest it. Now, package doesn't mean it has to be in the 10-pound batch, but it means we need another measurement and a bin it's in, a number on it, so we know it's been dried and we got a new weight and we know what's on site there. We have called out 181 people out of compliance over the past couple days. Our financial audit team did those calls. There's a number of reasons why people are out of compliance, and we're looking for them to move into compliance by March 1st, or otherwise we'll be going out and taking a look and seeing, you know, where the product is and what the reasons are for that. We do expect that a lot of them, you know, our system is confusing. Metric's not simple, but we're getting 80% of them are doing it. And so a lot of this issue is just knowing how to do it in metric and knowing what our requirement was in getting the job done. A lot of the smaller outdoor growers weren't staffed to deal with the big supplies that they got off these new Tier 1 gardens that we provided them out there. May have been smaller before, so some of their facilities weren't large enough. And so there's been some issues there, but I think we're going to see in the next, you know, by March 1, we're going to see a lot of folks moving into compliance, and we'll keep you updated on what that looks like. I did send out a letter from me advising all the industry about that. And really, you know, we just want to make sure that our system integrity issues are fixed. And, you know, if we get those fixes, then we don't have to go out and follow up. But, you know, use of the cannabis system just simply isn't voluntary. It has to be done. It's integral to the system that was created. And with that, we'll go to the next slide. Hemp, I'm not going to talk about hemp very much. You have DOJ here to talk about it later, but there was federal guidance. DOJ in Oregon interpreted that for us and for you, and so they're going to explain sort of what that means from the state of Oregon's perspective. And I also want to point out to you that we have a new mission statement. We're pretty proud of it. Our mission is to support businesses, public safety, and community livability through education and enforcement of liquor and marijuana laws. That's a big change since we saw you last time. Last session. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
What do you think, liquor versus alcohol?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to admit, from a business model standpoint, my heart sank when, Will, I heard you say licensing will slow down. You know, we just can't endure that. And as much as I hate to see government grow, if we're going to execute this business model, we've got to be as efficient with this as we possibly can. So I would just implore you to do all you can to take care of that situation, move people through, because there is a high level of frustration out there. And when it comes to streamlining testing, please, I hear so much about testing and dissatisfaction with that. And I hear the word bottleneck just all the time. And so, again, I would just implore you to do everything you can to make this a good, sound business model. And if we have to grow some government to do it, I think we have to. It may simmer down one of these days, and we won't need to stay as big as we have to be right now. But we have to be right now, I think. So.
Senator Brzezinski.
Madam Chair, thank you. Steve, just caught me off guard when you said up liquor and marijuana laws. Just real quickly, why liquor versus alcohol? It just seems like liquor, the definition, at least what I just pulled up, is talking about distilled products where others aren't.
And co-chairs, Senator Brzezinski, we debated that amongst our staff, agency-wide. In fact, everyone in the agency contributed this. We went back and forth and forth and back, and we ended up on liquor.
Put the coin.
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our next panel will be the Oregon Department of OHA and the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Andre Urso and Lauren Henderson.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andre Urso. I'm the manager of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. Thank you for letting me indulge myself in death by PowerPoint here. So, should be brief, and I'll get started here. So these numbers show comparisons and applications received in 2015 and 2016. OHA has undergone its first decline in cardholder applications in the history of the program in the year 2016. And also from January 2016 to January 2017, overall patient numbers have dropped 13%. Caregivers are down 21%, growers are down 22%, and grow sites are down 17%. And we attributed this to the transition over to the OLCC system. Here in this graphic, you can see the trend in applications since the inception of the program until 2016. And you can see here it is, of course, our first ever decrease in the amount of applications we've seen. For OMMP registered dispensaries, as of October 1st, 2016, which was approximately the time that the Liquor Commission started licensing its retail license, we had 427 registered OMMP dispensaries. As of yesterday, we now have 152 registered OMMP dispensaries. So we've had a significant decrease, about 65% of these dispensaries in the past few months.
Madam Chair, can I just interrupt on that?
Please.
Thanks. Andre, so you're seeing a big decrease on that. What are the patients doing? Have you gotten an idea at all? I mean, I've heard some, but I'm curious if you've heard anything, what they're planning or doing to in order to get the medicine.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Olson, as indicated, as percentage of them are receiving their medicine from OLCC licensed facilities at 13%. That's probably pretty low compared to, you know, the decrease in dispensaries. I have anecdotally heard that it's harder for patients to get the products that they need right now because dispensaries are converting over to the OLCC system or in the process of converting over. But, you know, many of the patients still grow their own and have transfers between amongst themselves that are not through registered dispensaries.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. So as you're aware, December 31st, 2016 was the end of the early start period of time where all retail and recreational sales were done through OMMP registered facilities. Since January 1st, we have conducted 212 end of early start compliance checks, and we've had over 97% compliance with that, which means that as of January 1st, 97% of these dispensaries that are still registered with us have not sold to recreational or retail customers. A little bit about processing applications. From April 1st to February 8th, we received 160 complete applications for processing, and this allowed these processors to process product and engage in business. We've moved back our processing and transfer deadlines from December 31st, 2016 and pushed it back to March 31st, 2017. This should allow processors some additional time to convert over to OLCC if they'd like to, or to get their applications completely registered with the Oregon Health Authority by the end of March. So as of February 8th, we have left of processors 18 complete applications. That means that only 18 processors can process within the OHA system. We've notified 51 of those that we are ready to conduct our inspection. So they may have already transferred over to OLCC, or they may not have submitted all their documents to us to be ready for an inspection, but we've let them know that we are ready for them. And as of date, we have three that are completely approved and registered. So a little bit about testing. And I recognize this is probably the largest issue right now facing the health authority and facing the regulation of cannabis in the state of Oregon. So in June 28th, OHA released its testing, labeling, and concentration rules. Those are rules that were directed to be implemented in HB 3400, which is now codified in 475B. Those rules went into effect on October 1st. That date was selected so it would coincide with the fall harvest and for the start of issuance of retail licenses by the Liquor Commission. In early December, the Oregon Health Authority released two sets of emergency temporary rules. Those were done in response to public pressure that the testing rules were too onerous and burdensome. So using the emergency testing rule process, we issued some rules that would have the effect of alleviating some of the regulatory burden on the industry. Beginning tomorrow, I have actually here, it should be February 10th through March 17th, we are conducting a rules advisory committee to look at testing rules again, and these will be permanent testing rules. So these rules will be implemented in accordance with the Administrative Procedures Act, and there will be a subsequent public comment hearing for everybody to participate in. The Rules Advisory Committee is consisting of members of the Oregon Cannabis Association, the Oregon, and I apologize if I get these acronyms incorrect, the Oregon Cannabis Business Council, Southern Oregon Growers, Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, ORLAP, and Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Mm-hmm. And then with the goal of having these rules implemented in place on June 1st. So in the process, since October 1st, we've had 19 labs accredited for various matrices. So that means that they can test for potency, water activity and moisture content, pesticides, solvents. Six labs are accredited specifically for pesticides. We have two additional labs going through the accreditation for pesticides and solvents currently right now. OTAC, which is the ORLAP Technical Advisory Committee, has recently invited a cannabis lab to sit on its advisory committee to address cannabis testing issues with ORLAP. And ORLAP continues active oversight of labs meeting TNI standards, which is the National Environmental Laboratory Program standards, and to comply with accreditation standards for ORLAP. They are also in the process of hiring two additional assessors. A little bit about pesticide testing. These numbers are based upon self-reports from laboratories. So we're seeing approximately about a 10% fail rate for usable marijuana. That is mostly medical marijuana and does not include the numbers for retail sales. We're seeing an approximate 26% fail rate for concentrates and extracts. According to the laboratories that reported, average turnaround time is about 10 days. And labs do report that they're operating under capacity at this time. So moving off of testing, some additional things coming out of the health authority, some publications and legislative reports. We have our mid-campaign results for the youth prevention campaign, which just came out. Our HB 4014 guidelines for attending physicians was released as well. So that will provide some clinical guidelines for physicians when recommending the use of marijuana to patients. And then our SB 1598 remote dispensing report is out as well. And those are all available on our OHA publications website. And additionally, coming forward in 2017 would be our online patient application system. We're very excited about this. This should cut down on the amount of paper and really cut down on the processing time for patient applications. So thank you, and I'd be willing to take any questions from members of the committee.
Thank you, Adam. I think it would be good to get those reports on the committee OLIS page.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will post those either tonight or tomorrow.
Thank you. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to page 9, can you tell us what time period that information about pesticide testing covers?
Madam Co-Chair. Representative Faye, this is going to be total testing as of October 1st to current date, so yesterday, February 8th.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Przanski.
Yeah. You mentioned membership for the RAC. Caught me off guard when you said Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Knowing what they promote, which is use of chemicals, et cetera, what are they bringing to the table?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Przanski. I think they bring an expertise in food production and agricultural crop production and the use of pesticides. So they would know what pesticides are appropriate for increasing crop yields, but without endangering public health and safety.
Senator Cruz.
Just a clarification, Oregonians for Food and Shelter don't advocate for the use of chemicals. They advocate for farming in appropriate manners and using what's necessary and safe.
Thank you, Senator.
But Monsanto is their largest contributor.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andre, I want to ask you about the prevailing winds that are blowing through this place. And I think we all realize that there's a big push to have everybody under OLCC. A a lot of people have griped about OMMP and OHA over time, but as they look at OLCC, they're starting to fall in love with OHA and OMMP again. And I would just like you to say a few things about your program. Why, in your opinion, there needs to be an OMMP under OHA?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wilson. So first of all, the program under OHA has had really three duties since October 2015. It was to, of course, register patients and caregivers and their growers. It was to allow access to their products. It was also to implement the robust regulatory system involved in HB 3400, which meant implementing rules and regulations related to consumer safety protections, such as testing. And then also was to oversee and regulate recreational sales from October 2015 to December 31st, 2016. So the agency's had its hands full, and it's definitely taken its share of criticism, and in some cases, rightfully so. But overall, I think we've done a very good job in handling the duties that have been handed down to us. As we move forward, you know, I think my opinion also represents the opinion of the agency is that we see that for bureaucratic efficiency's sake, there really shouldn't be two parallel regulatory systems, but that there's still going to be a necessity for patients to have a program to be in. For example, they're going to have substantial tax benefits on the medicines that they purchase. They're going to have access to medicines that have higher concentrations than the general public would have access to, and they also should have access to higher levels of medicine that the general public wouldn't have access to as well. So I do think that there is a place for the registry program within the state of Oregon, and it's up to this body and this legislature to determine exactly how that would be shaped.
Thanks.
Good questions. Thank you very much. Agriculture.
Good evening. For the record, Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Sunny Jones, who is our Cannabis Policy Coordinator. And I brought Sunny with me to talk a little bit about an issue that we've had on the pesticide front on the guide list, and I'll leave that to her to talk at the end here. I just wanted to remind the committee, our agency's been in the role of being a support agency for both programs, continue to be in that role in the best way that we can. And ongoing work related to food safety, our weights and measures program, that is the program that has the scales, our pesticides program, and then what Sunny spends a lot of her time doing, which is just being there for anyone in this industry if they have questions related to our agency and trying to get to their events and be present. And we think that's really important and continue to do that ongoing work. As far as specific information about our specific programs, I brought just some brief data to share with you. On the food safety side, I think the last time I spoke to you, we hadn't licensed too many folks. That has changed. We're up to 252 licenses now, and that list keeps growing. We are trying to keep up with that demand, and I think so far are doing that. Our staff, the licensing makes up retail, warehouses, food processing, and bakeries even. And so I asked our staff to tell me what are they encountering? Is there anything different that they wouldn't encounter with a regular business? And they said, you know, these are just like the other businesses we've been working with, same kinds of issues. An example of that might be the hand washing stations that they might have or may not be quite right. Sinks need to be moved or other things like that. But for overall, they're not seeing any difference, and so I think that's good news on that front. It's just our normal work, and our staff are out consulting where they can, trying to get people on the right foot to get their license as fast as they can. The only other thing that they mentioned to me is our licensing structure. It has to go to a specific business or person, and we've had some difficulty finding out who really is the responsible person for that particular business, but that's just ongoing work and some phone calls, and so we've been doing fine with that. On the weights and measures side, this I think tends to be more straightforward. That list is now up to 1,674 devices. So some businesses may have multiple scales. The scale accuracy is very important. It's important not only for the consumers, it's also important for the businesses. You don't want to give your product away, so it's important that you have accuracy in that system, and our staff have been working to maintain that. I think the biggest challenge there is you just can't go to Walmart and get one of those scales. They're expensive, and if you know, to get that accuracy, and so our staff are working with folks to try to get the best places to maybe purchase those where we can so that they are affordable because they are expensive. I think we're on the second round of scale renewals for some folks, so we're going to see, I hope, some efficiencies there now that they're on board with the program, and that should be much easier, that renewal process to get them renewed when we need to do those inspections. And last but not least, our pesticides program. You've heard a little bit about failed testing. Those failed tests are being referred over to our staff for pesticide investigations, and it became very clear to us that if we used our normal investigatory process, which is very thorough and includes lots more lab testing right at the get-go, that we as an agency ourselves could put a total stop to sales and distribution because we would have so much of the samples embargoed. And so that led us to think outside the box and come up with, I think, what you heard Mr. Jeff Rhodes talk about at your last hearing, the Marijuana Compliance Assistant Program. It is a temporary program, and the purpose of that is to really put people in the know about pesticide regulation and what it means and why it's important. And so we developed an alternative program. That program currently was set to expire in June. I think our agencies collectively will talk more this spring to say, how's it going? And where does that program really need to go going forward? I certainly think if we need to extend it for some reasons, we can have those discussions. In my mind, it's doing exactly what we needed to do. One, we've not had any bee repeats yet. I hope that continues. We've had 63 growers that have gone through that alternative process. And really what the alternative process is, it's a consent process in which they agree to some things and we agree to some things. One of the things that we agree to is no civil penalties. Some of the things they agree to is that they will allow us to do some inspection, that we won't detain any of their product. We leave the parts about whether that can go into commerce to the respective agencies that referred it to us. We do enter it as a violation, so it counts towards their three-year history, a part of that agreement. But one of the things that I think is probably the most important is that the grower and the employees are required to complete some training. And this training is really geared towards our pesticide laws and why they're important and label, how to read a label and those kinds of things. I'm here to tell you that I think we've had everyone but one grower go through that process successfully. And it's been very timely, and it's got them back on their feet as fast as we can. We'll continue to do that. Now, the incentive part of why would somebody want to sign one of those consent agreements is that part of that program also says that if they come back to us, so they've gotten a second one after the education, that it will go through our normal matrix that would involve a more thorough investigation, just like we do for everybody else in our state. So there's that program, and like I said, we will review that in the spring and see how we're doing with our sister agencies, and that'll be a collective decision on what happens with that program going forward. I'll just mention those 63 growers. I can't tell you how many samples that one has failed, but it's in the hundreds, and it's quite a few. So the other thing on the pesticide front, and this is a little bit unusual, we have found that we've had some folks failing tests on an active ingredient that actually is on the not allowed side and on our guide list. And that has puzzled us as an agency. And so I'm going to just stop there, if it's okay, and have Sunny explain what we're asking those growers to do and the help that we need, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Good evening. For the record, Sunny Jones, Cannabis Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Department of Ag. And pesticides are a complicated topic, so I'll try and keep it straight and to the point, but I might get a little down the rabbit trail. ODA's guide list is set up based on certain ideas that pesticides have to be labeled for a crop. Obviously, the federal government doesn't recognize cannabis, so that provides a bit of a problem. And So what we did was we said, rather than saying don't use anything, we set up some criteria. If the active ingredient in that product is exempt from the requirement of a tolerance, i.e. the EPA has said it's low enough risk, we're not going to establish a residue level when you harvest crops, food crops, then we said it could be on the list. So it's based on products, not on active ingredient. You know that the OHA list is based on active ingredient. There's, 59 analytes that are on that list. That's the active ingredient. So first criteria, exempt from the requirement of a tolerance. Second criteria, the label directions are broad enough that it would allow for use on general food crops that we think cannabis could fall into. And then if a pyrolysis study has been done, i.e. what happens when you smoke it, and it did not fail that test, then those products are on ODA's guide list. We currently have a little over 300 products on that list. There are two...
But there's no restricted chemicals. It's all... I mean, so you don't have to be a licensed...
Madam co-chairs, Senator Cruz, that is correct.
Okay.
No RUPs, no restricted use pesticides. Okay. Those would not fall into this. They all have established tolerances, et cetera.
I know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excellent point. So you've got this guide list. You've got 300 products. Two active ingredients, pyrethrins and piperonyl butoxide, or PBO, are exempt from the requirement of the tolerance by EPA if they're applied pre-harvest, i.e. before you take the crop out of the field. However, there are also product chemicals that are used quite frequently in the cannabis industry, have been used historically in the cannabis industry when it was black market. So that's how it ended up on both lists. It meets our criteria. It also met the criteria that OHA set up for determining what analytes would be on there. So we have folks failing that are telling us we used a product on ODA's guide list and we used it according to the label directions, and now we're failing on the OHA side. So we know that we have a certain number of growers that have run into that situation and are telling us that. Now, some of them may be correct, some of them may not. Some of them may be confused because there's not a lot of education in the cannabis industry yet around pesticide use. So what ODA is trying to determine in coordination with our sister agencies is, have people use these products or products containing these two active ingredients and not failed? And if so, what are they doing? How are they applying those products?
Following the label.
So we sent out a joint letter from ODA, OLCC, and OHA via our listservs to the industry asking for them to provide information. Now, I've been out of the office for a week, so I can't tell you how many folks we've had that have called in, but we're hoping to receive that kind of information. What was the rate of application? What was the timing? How soon before they harvested? How much did they use? What dilution if it was a product that was concentrated? So we're looking for the industry to work with us so that we can help them by maintaining really useful tools on that guide list.
Thank you. Question?
Just a couple comments. I think this is the right place. This is where the expertise is, and I'm almost surprised that there's nothing on the restricted list. There could be. The nice thing about if you have to use things on the restricted list, you have to go to class and learn what you're doing. And certified pesticide applicators have continuing ed. You have to keep going back and back and back and learning more. And I think that's maybe, Madam Chair, part of the problem here. Number one, there's a whole lot of stuff on the internet that says you can do this, that, and the other thing, which is problematic. But I think what we need to do is educate the industry as to what is safe, what is available, and what the proper way to use the products is. Because once they have that, then I think a lot of the problems will go away.
Yeah, and I think once you get your information back from your queries, it would be good to have you back and report on. Because this has been a real hot button issue for quite a while.
Madam Chair, if I could, I think I think from our perspective, the information is valuable because we're sending a mixed message right now to folks when you have two lists. We don't want to do that. We either need to make a decision that it can't stay on the guide list, or we need to reconcile what's happening. And the only way we can do that is to figure out why some people are failing and some are not, and what's happening there. And so that information is not a gotcha. That's not what we want. We really want to try to figure it out so we can provide the best information going forward.
Great. It sounds like education will be a big component of that. Other questions? Thank you very much. Our next panel is the Department of Justice, Shannon O'Fallon, and Erin Williams.
May I ask a question while our panel gets started? One thing that I would love to have us get information on, it doesn't have to be today, is what the overall number of businesses created has been since the maybe since January 1, 2015, or what number of legal marijuana businesses exist in the state, and the number of people employed in those businesses, and if it were possible, and I think there may be some information existing on this, the economic impact of the sector in Oregon. It would be interesting, Mr. Crawford, if perhaps sometime you could come back and give us data on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, I will put that on my list and work with OLCC and others to otherwise get numbers for you.
Thanks.
Great. Welcome.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shannon O'Fallon. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, and with me is Erin Williams, also an attorney with the Oregon Department of Justice, and she really is the real expert on what I'm going to be talking about today, so if there are more specific questions, I wanted her here as my lifeline. So you asked us to come today and talk about some advice that was issued back in December, I believe it was December, to ODA, OHA, and OLCC about some recent guidance from the federal government related to industrial hemp. So I'll talk briefly about the federal guidance and DOJ's advice and recommendations, and then answer any questions. So under the current Federal Controlled Substances Act, the CSA, cultivation of all cannabis, regardless of THC content, is prohibited. But under the federal farm bill, there's a limited exception to the CSA's blanket prohibition on cannabis production. So lawful production of hemp is permitted under a state research program that meets certain federal standards. If you have a state industrial hemp program that maybe isn't fully consistent with the farm bill, the production, processing, and sale of hemp may still be sort of tolerated under federal law if the production, processing, and sale conforms to the Cole Memo standards, and I think that you're all pretty familiar with those Cole Memo standards. So to limit the risk of federal intervention, a state hemp program should either be fully consistent with the farm program or with a Cole Memorandum. And our concern is that Oregon's industrial hemp laws might not be fully consonant with either of those things. So, for example, Oregon's industrial hemp statutes do not explicitly recognize a research element, and they provide ODA with little authority to regulate and track the production of hemp. Oregon law also permits hemp to be processed into products for human consumption, including the processing of hemp into CBD products. And again, the industrial hemp statutes give ODA little authority over the regulation or tracking of the processing of those hemp products. OLCC and OHA also can't regulate these hemp products because industrial hemp products are specifically excluded from the definition of marijuana under the statutes. So, in August of 2016, USDA, USDEA, and the FDA issued what's called a Statement of Principles on industrial hemp. They explained the requirements for growing hemp under the Farm Bill and identified significant limitations on the scope of authorized activities. And in particular, the Statement of Principles said that under the Farm Bill, the industrial hemp production is limited to fiber and seed and not CBDs. The DEA also just issued a regulation that defines marijuana extract so that it appears to include CBD products, so they define it very broadly. And that may indicate that DEA intends to treat CBD products as a Schedule I substance under the CSA. And as you probably know, a significant amount of the hemp in Oregon is grown for purposes of production of CBD. So in our view, to limit the risk of federal intervention in Oregon's industrial hemp programs or Oregon's marijuana programs, our recommendation is that the industrial hemp program should be compliant with the Farm Bill or pulled into the state's sort of more robustly regulated marijuana system. So you could allow OLCC to regulate the industrial hemp used for CBD production, bringing the CBD segment of the hemp industry into compliance with the Cole Memo, and bring the remaining segment of the hemp industry into compliance with the Farm Bill by amending ODA statutes that ODA regulates industrial hemp used for purposes other than CBD production, fiber and seed, designating Oregon's industrial hemp program as an agricultural pilot program to research the growth, cultivation, or marketing of industrial hemp, and then giving ODA adequate rulemaking authority over that. So that's the upside. I'm happy to answer any questions.
So if they brought the CBD into the OLCC program, they would do it into OLCC. So it would be subject to the testing rules and all the regulatory requirements.
Right. Madam Co-Chair, it essentially would treat a CBD product made from hemp the same way that an extract or concentrate or anything else made from marijuana is made. So it would just be regulated in the same way.
Okay. Senator Krasinski.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Maybe for the lifeline, I'm looking at the Farm Act, and I thought it does, and it sounds like it's called for industrial hemp being defined not being marijuana. And if it took it out of the definition of marijuana from back in the 70s when it was brought in, I'm not sure how DEA is now saying they may potentially regulate it as if it was marijuana.
Secretary Senator Pronsky, that is an excellent point, and I think that is what.
Yourself for the record.
Sorry, for the record, this is Erin Williams with the Department of Justice. I think that is a good point, and I think that is what those in the industry are asserting as well. But at this point, we're doing our best to interpret what DEA's perspective is and how the DEA is planning to enforce these laws, and that is why we have this, why we issued the advice and why we have this caution based on the DEA's, what we understand the DEA's position to be.
Madam Chair, if I can just follow up. I mean, based on, again, what this says, it doesn't sound like the DEA should have any jurisdiction since it's not a controlled substance. So I'm hoping that we, in representing our state and growers in the state, are making that, are considering that point, I should say, as to what jurisdiction does that agency have over hemp when it was written out of the Controlled Substance Act. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to state for the record, being highly vested in this whole industrial hemp process, we have every intention of working to shore up that bill to comply with Farm Bill or coal standards as it relates to seed and fiber especially. We want to get the doable done as we can and perhaps look at the other as a longer-term project, but yet a necessary project. So being the sponsor, along with Co-Chair Liner last time, we have every intention of making that program work. So we want to work with you and the other stakeholders to make that happen.
Great. Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wilson, we're happy to help in any way we can.
Thank you.
Senator Ferrioli.
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure that I'm on the same page with everyone here. CBD hemp derived from hemp has been classed as a Schedule I drug, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Fairley, I think that's what the DEA would say.
Well, since they are an authority over the classification system, it isn't that they would say it, it's that they did say it. So, Madam Chair, and not to be argumentative with my good co-vice chair, which there are the only two of us in the world, co-vice chairs, it is a class one scheduled drug. So, you know, nobody has advised Amazon Prime, because I'm online right now and I see 200 different kinds of products for pain relief based, you know, that are CBD oils that are available, but perhaps to be delivered by a UAV to my door. You know, some's produced in Oregon, some's produced in Canada, California. So the incongruity of this thing is a Schedule One derived from hemp. I hope they don't think that all of the those hemp plants are being grown for rope, because that's not what's happening. So it just illustrates that we probably need to be really working hard on our own congressional delegation to tell them you can't keep the cross purposes and the cross communication, because confusion is the result. I think some 29 states are, you know, have already legalized some form of cannabis use, medical rec or both. Every year or every 6 months, it's another bunch of them. And I think critical mass is coming. It just seems to me that we should be able to communicate clearly with the new U.S. attorney for Oregon, whoever that will be, that this is an incongruency that we can't live with. So I do have a question off the topic, perhaps, and you may know this and can shed some light on this. My understanding is that the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Spring got the nasty gram from BATF that U.S. banks, in fact, ended the banking relationship with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs based on a letter they got from the regulators, banking regulators. I wondered if you knew anything about that or could shed some light on that.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Farrelly, I do not know anything about that.
Worth some further inquiry.
Yeah, well, I talked to the tribal representatives and they're getting me a copy of the letter, so I'm pretty sure it's occurred. Another incongruency. Mm. The Confederated Tribes have moved, I believe, to their banking business to a credit union. Well, they weren't going to just sit around without a credit card. Come on. You know. But the incongruency between credit unions and banks just is another intolerable contradiction. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm listening to Senator Farrelly here with his presentation. And then both of you. And I guess I'm just trying to kind of draw a little bit more of a black and white on this. I mean, are you insinuating that there's medical value here?
Co-chairs. Representative Olson, I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. I hope I'm not insinuating anything.
Well, I mean, of course, the senator helped out with that.
Okay, now, Representative Olson, please do not harass the witness.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Badgering.
Badgering. Okay, other questions? Thank you very much. Okay, our final witness to bring us home is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel.
Oh, he looks
that's
familiar.
That's fine. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Mark, we're going to have there we go.
Thank you. Chairs Leininger, Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I am the attorney from the Office of Legislative Counsel that drafts in this particular area. I was asked to come here today to basically go over some of the consolidation bills or other restructuring bills that have been requested to make sure everybody understands, in the spirit of transparency and clarity, what is in these different bills and how they are different from one another. I'll try to make my comments quick and move through them as quickly as possible. This only concerns bills that were dropped. So if you don't see a bill on this list, it's because you didn't drop it. Excuse me.
It hasn't been assigned yet.
I'm going to begin with Senate Bill 1511 from 2016. And the reason I want to start there is just to remind the committee what occurred in the previous legislative session, where a lot of this work that would normally be seen in these bills was previously done, particularly with given the Oregon Liquor Control Commission regulatory power over medical grade cannabis and the sale and production and processing of those type of products. So something this committee took up in that session, Senate Bill 1511, that bill allowed the registration by producers, processors, and sellers of marijuana through the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to basically produce medical grade marijuana, process medical grade products, and then sell those products at stores if they're specially registered through the commission. Some highlights, this isn't everything, of course. Registered producers of marijuana may enter into contractual agreements with Oregon Medical Marijuana Program patient cardholders, under which patient cardholders may receive marijuana directly from the producer, and the producer may increase the producer's canopy size. Registered processors of marijuana may process marijuana into medical products, and registered wholesalers and registered retailers of marijuana may sell marijuana that is a medical product. So that was something that had been previously done. That is law, and it will be codified next time that we undertake that task in our office. On to this session's bills. Senate Bill 306, simple consolidation. Senate Bill 306 is a fairly simple bill. It's about 30 or 40 pages long, and it only takes on one goal, and that is to require the regulatory consolidation of marijuana businesses. On the 91st day after adjournment signee died, the Oregon Health Authority may no longer register grow sites, processing sites, or dispensaries underneath this bill. So that'll stop, and they will no longer add anybody into their into the program. And then on June 30th, 2008, all grow sites, processing sites, or dispensaries must be licensed by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. So it gives them approximately a year after the end of this session to migrate over into OLCC's system. House Bill 2200, 2017, a little bit more complicated, a few more things added onto this one. It also requires consolidation of marijuana businesses. It changes the name and composition of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And it requires the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the State Department of Agriculture to coordinate efforts in regulating the production of marijuana. And I'll speak about that in a little bit more detail than some of the other points. In House Bill 2200, on the 91st day after adjournment signee die, as with the previous bill, the Oregon Health Authority may no longer register grow sites, processing sites, or dispensaries. Also on the 91st day, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is renamed the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission, at least statutorily. Might take some time, I guess, to replicate that in the real world. It changes the composition of the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission by adding four representatives from the marijuana industry to the commission. And then it requires Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission and the State Department of Agriculture to coordinate efforts in regulating the production of marijuana. That's toward the end of House Bill 2200. And essentially what the language requires is for them to enter into an agreement where the two agencies decide how is the State Department of Agriculture is going to play a role in the regulation of the production of marijuana, and then to report back to the legislature as to what they think needs to be done statutorily. That section is repealed on December 31st of 2018, so if it doesn't work out, it goes away. If it does work out, there will be a report as to what they want to see happen in the future. House Bill 2198 from 2017. This adds a few more elements, and it is probably the most complicated of the three bills that I've gone through so far. So 91st day after adjournment, signee die. Same provision about the about OHA no longer registering these sites or businesses. Same as with House Bill 2200, it renames the Liquor Control Commission to the Cannabis Commission. In the same way as House Bill 2200, it changes the composition of the Cannabis Commission to include four members representing the marijuana industry. And it also has that same language about requiring the Cannabis Commission, the State Department of Agriculture to work together. The one major difference, and this is a very substantial difference between this bill and House Bill 2200, is that it creates a program in which the State Department of Agriculture will provide for the regulation of medical marijuana grow sites. That's very different. And I'll just say a couple things about those provisions. Whether or not it was the correct choice to draft it this way, it is modeled after the hemp statutes to a certain degree. But at the same time, it folds in the language that is currently in statute with how OLCC marijuana producers interact with patient cardholders. And so through contracts underneath this model, medical marijuana grow sites that want to migrate over to the State Department of Agriculture instead of OLCC, they'll be allowed to enter into contracts with patient cardholders. And they'll be producing marijuana for them through those contracts. Even though it becomes effective on the 91st day after adjournment, signee die, if you look carefully at Section 312M in the bill, there is a little bit of play in how long they have to develop their system.
You said Section 312M?
Correct. Yeah, Section 312M. And all of those sections, they're toward the end of the bill, and they are basically sections 312A through 312N.
So, Mark, so you'd have to be in two separate programs if you wanted to be medical and recreational at the same time. So it'd be two different. I mean, because we in that you've got the Cannabis Commission and Department of Ag coordinating efforts for regulation, but then you have a whole separate piece for the medical side. So somebody that's wanting to do both would still have two hoops to jump through, correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, no, the way the bill is drafted is that a medical growth site would have to leave OHA and enter into one of two different systems. They could either choose to become licensed as a marijuana producer by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, in which case they would be able to grow products and distribute them through that distribution chain, as well as enter into contracts with patient cardholders.
Okay.
But if they would rather, they could go into the ag system and be regulated by the State Department of Agriculture. So two different, again, it presents a choice as there is now.
So if I could, so basically you could be strictly medical or you could be both or strictly recreational over here.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that is correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Presenza.
And just for clarification, if you went with the ag with the contracts, you would not be able to take your excess and put it into the retail system. Everything would have to stay within the medical.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, this is where it gets a little bit complicated, and it is somewhat modeled after the current statute for producers underneath the OLCC system to enter into those contracts. The way it works underneath this bill is that if you enter into such a contract, all the marijuana, except as otherwise agreed to, belongs to the patient cardholder, up to the amount they want. Mm-hmm. The excess can then be used for various purposes. And the way it's written now is it can be sold into the OLCC system by these people who are registered by the State Department of Agriculture, but only to those stores that sell medical products. So it would have to be a medical sale.
Got it.
Thank other you. Questions? Excellent. Okay, thank you. I agree, this is the more complicated bill.
Yeah. On June 30th of 2018, in this particular bill, again, all grow sites, processing sites, and dispensaries must be licensed by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission underneath this model by this date, except for the grow sites that go to State Department of Ag, and that's my error on this presentation. And then this bill also creates a medical use of cannabis board within the Oregon Health Authority to oversee the remaining functions of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. And essentially what that means is within the Oregon Health Authority, there's a board that's created that would adopt rules and oversee the administration of it. They'd be the rulemaking body. And then one last bill, Senate Bill 300. Senate Bill 300 creates the Oregon Cannabis Commission to oversee the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. Again, it's a simpler bill. It's your basic transfer bill. I know you all have seen these types of bills before on the committee. It creates the Oregon Cannabis Commission, and then it transfers the duties, functions, and powers relating to the medical program from the health authority to this new commission. Along with that, it includes a mission statement for the commission that includes duties that are a little bit beyond just regulating the medical product. The mission statement is a little bit broader. They're supposed to coordinate and work with OLCC. But it doesn't fundamentally change the OLCC system or the hemp program or anything like that. What it basically does is it creates a board to oversee the medical program. And that is that. Are there any questions?
Questions from the panel. We will, members, be having, obviously, hearings on all these, so they'll be fleshed out much more. Mark, just a quick question, just process-wise, that last bill with the Cannabis Commission, would it be possible to have the OLCC part of it folded into that? Would that be something that could be accomplished logistically?
Madam Chairs, members of the committee, yeah, I could write a bill that would create a separate agency from both the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission that would basically run all the current statutory functions, duties, and powers. And it would be, it would be a time-consuming bill, but not a particularly difficult one to write.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Senator Prasansky, you're shaking your head.
No questions. I just intriguing. I would have to go through those four bills. I think the one that's very complex may take care of a lot of the problems that some of the smaller mom-and-pop growers have been concerned about being able to afford to go into the OLCC system. They would still have a mechanism to actually have their excess stay within the medical program, but it would be through the OLCC retail that does medical sales. So if that's what it does, it may really fill a void that I've heard many people who are very concerned that they want to provide for their patients, they need a means to get rid of their excess, but they cannot afford to go through all of this other bureaucratic licensing requirements at the cost of cameras, etc.
Representative Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree with Senator Prozonsky, and I think there are some other nodding heads up here as well, and that is that as we move ahead and the inertia picks up, we have to remember the small mom and pops who are the backbone of this operation from the very beginning. And I think we're in great danger of pricing them out of the game,
right,
which I think is absolutely a shame.
Yep.
So I'll look forward to having that as a value that some of us have as we move ahead and look at some intriguing concepts.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was nodding strongly in favor in agreement with those comments.
Okay, he associated himself with those comments. Excellent. All right, any other questions? Thank you, committee. We've finished on time. That's a tradition of this committee. And we will be working to try to get our starting time at 5 o'clock. I don't know that we'll be successful, but get people out of here earlier.
5 o'clock on Tuesdays.
On Tuesdays. And our next meeting will be Tuesday.
5:15.
So we are adjourned. We are adjourned. So,